From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review Bad Boys for Life. It's the third in the trilogy of films pairing Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. We'll find out if the newest version of the action comedy holds the laughs of the earlier ones. Also, we have a brand new version of Dr. Dolittle starring Robert Downey Jr. It's directed by and co-written by Stephen Gagan. And Troop Zero stars Viola Davis, which takes us back to rural Georgia in 1977. We'll also talk with an intimacy coordinator who counsels actors as they go through sex scenes while they're being filmed. It's Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. We get started right after NPR News. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And my pleasure to introduce this week's critics, Leah Lowenstein and Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. First up this week is the third film in the series of Bad Boys movies. It's Bad Boys for Life. The film reteams Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, their loose cannon Miami PD detective duo Mike Lowry and Marcus Burnett.
So we're just going to do a knock and talk.
What?
Hey, look, all our lives we've been bad boys, all right? Now it's time to be good men. Who in the hell want to sing that song?
Good man, what you gonna do?
Well, maybe if you sing the song like you meant it, it'll catch on. No. Knock and talk.
Yeah, knock, knock.
Bad Boys for Life. The film is directed by Adil Ilarbi and Bilal Fallah. The film written by Chris Bremner, Peter Craig, and Joe Carnahan. Amy, what did you think about Bad Boys for Life?
Good men. Good men. I love that clip. I mean, I love that Bad Boys, the franchise, is 25 years old, and they are now saying, maybe it's time to grow up a little bit. But that's what this movie is about. You know, you have this partnership of Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. They're finally at a stage. Martin Lawrence has just become a grandfather in the first scene of the movie, where maybe they should slow down the pace of their life a little bit and not spend their life speeding through Miami on Ferraris, maybe killing a dozen pedestrians every time it seems like they step out the door because they drive so recklessly, and shooting a lot of bullets everywhere you can. I think we should start by talking about, you know, Bad Boys is maybe the most important franchise in Will Smith's career. Like, this is the movie that made him a movie star 25 years ago. It was the first big thing he did that proved he could hold his own when he wasn't the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And I think it is really interesting that we're at a point right now in Will Smith's career where he's having a hard time figuring out how to make a big hit again. You know, he played a cop with an orc partner on a Netflix movie called Bright. He's been floundering to find himself. So I think he's decided, I'm going to go back to basics. We're going to go back to the Bad Boys universe. And I'm going to make a movie that feels very 90s. You know, this is the glamorous, shoot 'em up, absolutely conscience-free mayhem type of movie that I haven't seen in a minute. You know, I feel like we've been maturing past this, but Bad Boys is here to be like, no. Let's just be like reckless children again.
Well, and it would be hard for them to depart too much from the theme of the earlier films, right? Because that's what the audience would be seeking
Absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. This is also the franchise that pretty much made Michael Bay. When Bad Boys came out in 1995, it was sort of, you know, Will Smith was already a bankable star in terms of TV work and was, you know, already was well-liked. But this sort of...
I think he'd done 6 Degrees of Separation.
And been nominated, I think, for an Oscar for that, I believe. And so this really sort of was a benchmark in his career. It launched... It relaunched them as a duo to be reckoned with, and the best in the tradition of best buddy movies. It together they're better than they are separately. And for me, Amy, this movie was better than it had any right to be. It 25 years on, the third in a series, it should not be this funny, this watchable, this good. But the fact is there's so much chemistry between Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. There's a certain amount of reflection going on about, you know, where we are in our lives. You know, should we give up violence? Should we choose a different path? And there's a fair amount of discussion about that. But of course, that's jettisoned out the window when needed. And I thought it delivers everything that you're looking for in an action comedy movie. There's great chemistry. There's great action scenes. There's great dynamism between the leads. There's some good lines. There's good improv. You know, I only didn't like the last action scene, which was, I thought, too hectic, too frenetic, too much like a video game. It's that sort of motion smoothed excess of violence that I don't care for. But the rest of it, I thought there's even a pretty decent storyline. Right?
Now I want to take
not that you're going for that.
Right.
But
I mean, but it gets a little hokey in moments, but yeah. I mean,
I would pound Red Bull and watch it with you again. I would pound an energy drink and be like, let's see what's
happening.
Did
you two get see it together?
I
mean,
we must have been at the same one, but I
saw it last night at a nearly sold out public screening on a Thursday night.
All right.
I think, you know, before the film is officially opened, I thought, here's a movie with great word of mouth that people are excited to see. It's pretty hard to sell out a theater on a Thursday night before the movie's actually open. So I was really impressed. People are excited about it and people were talking about
it. So
are
you both looking forward to Bad Seniors? They hit 70.
Well, you
can
tell in here what they want to do is turn this into the Fast and Furious franchise.
Oh, yeah.
It felt a little obvious to me the seams they were putting together to keep this franchise going. They introduce a young, new, hip kind of CSI Miami group called Ammo. They're all very young and telegenic with Vanessa Hudgens.
But this film is about the two guys. I don't understand.
But they had all the supporting cast, Vanessa Hudgens, Joe Pantoliano, like people like that to sort of give you a little bit of momentum to carry it forward and with the millennials, of course. But yes, Amy's right. They were setting up something very clearly, and there's a teaser at the end of the movie. There's another Bad Boys that must be in the works already. Wish that wasn't so calculated, but I think that it sure was a heck of a lot of fun.
I mean, it's too bad for them that Johnny Knoxville already took the title Bad Grandpa.
Yeah, right. Bad Boys for Life, the third film in the Bad Boys series. Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. The film's rated R, and you can see it in theaters everywhere. A new version of Dr. Dolittle is out. Robert Downey Jr. stars. Stephen Gagan is the director and co-screenwriter. The film is titled simply Dolittle. Lael.
Well, why would be my first question. Was it necessary to have a new Dolittle? And, you know, given the beloved, I remember from my childhood, Rex Harrison version, which, you know, still stands up for me, although it doesn't really hold up in repeated viewings. But, there were some fun moments in it. And then, of course, the Eddie Murphy.
I really liked that one.
Yeah, those were kind of fun. I think that was a fun revamp on the genre. But, you know, given my built-in aversion to CGI with talking animals, I think this is the best use you're going to get of that. And you do have Robert Downey Jr. kind of running around essentially it sort of reimagines him as a depressed, kind of slightly mentally ill, kind of befuddled old doctor who's been shut alone in this estate, who then has to go cure Queen Victoria in order to save his family estate. The story is completely nonsensical. it was utterly bizarre and written by Stephen Gagan, of all people. I couldn't really figure it out where he did Traffic. Yes. And is a fine writer, but it felt like this was a complete pastiche, just trying to throw together so many different scenes that really made no sense. There's a business of they're trying to find Dolittle's lost wife's journal on an island somewhere in Monteverde in order to find a very rare tree that can possibly cure Queen Victoria. A lot of this made no sense. That they're sort of just excuses for these set pieces, one with a dragon that swallowed a bagpipe, I don't know.
Is it aimed at kids, clearly?
Clearly aimed at kids, and the two in the theater that I was with last night seemed to enjoy it, the two little girls. But I can't say that there's a lot to be to recommend.
You had a busy night last night.
It was very busy.
Doolittle, Bad Boys, back to back.
Yes, and wow. Bad Boys was the highlight.
You didn't confuse the two plot lines.
Also, what was up with Robert Downey Jr.'s accent? It sort of went in, it went out. It was nuts. It was weird.
So, Amy, what do you think?
Well, I'll admit, when I found out I was going to be here with you, Larry, on Doolittle Week, I thought maybe I will fake my own death because I did not want to see this movie at all. If I was ranking the things I hate the most, animal reaction shots are probably my number one. You know, la-da-da, cut to the dog. And I was like, oh, God, why am I in for an entire movie of animal reaction shots? This will be the nightmare of my entire existence.
Except Wallace and Gromit, I would hope.
And yet when I sat down at Doolittle and the first 10 minutes unfold and you see Robert Downey Jr. as depressed with his gigantic beard, hooting and scratching himself, I made a bunch of predictions about the plot. I was like, oh, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. Here we go. And to the movie's credit, none of that came true. And it was surprising. There's a moment really early on when a young boy shoots a squirrel. And when the squirrel wakes up from its coma, it has this Apocalypse Now kind of flashback that suddenly changed the tenor of this entire movie for me. I was like, oh, they're going somewhere completely different than I thought. There's an octopus in here who has the phrase, snitches get stitches. And I will say, I laughed out loud. Yeah. And I will say,
Amy,
I might have preferred this to Bad Boys, and I cannot believe I am saying that. Maybe a gorilla has taken over my body because I thought this was fine.
Do you remember when the squirrel said, and I quote, I feel like I got a front row seat to Crazy Town? Because that's what I felt like while I was watching the movie.
Okay, but do you remember when the polar bear talks about how important friendship is, bro?
No, sis. I definitely... I think you saw a different movie than me. I'm glad that yours was a hallucinogenic Apocalypse Now kind of flashback, but mine was...
I mean, it's there. Somehow Doolittle convinced Antonio Banderas to be in this movie.
Yeah.
It convinced Ralph Fiennes to play a mentally psychotic tiger. There's a lot of people, Emma Thompson as a parrot.
Yeah, yeah.
So for you, it was just incomprehensible, Lael.
No, for me, it was sort of a yawn. It was sort of like, you know, was this... what? The animals, I actually think the best thing about it was the animals. And for me to say that computer rendered animals are the best thing about a movie it's a big reach for me. But I felt like Downey sort of didn't really know. I didn't feel like his heart was in the movie. I don't know.
Well, that's shocking.
Yeah.
Downey's heart not being in a giant expensive movie? When has that happened?
Well, he lost it back with Tony Stark a long time.
We're talking about Doolittle, directed by Stephen Gagan, who co-wrote it. Adventure comedy is rated PG in wide release. Also out this week, the comedic drama Troop Zero. The film stars McKenna Grace as a misfit girl with dreams of going out into space, growing up in rural 1970s Georgia. When a competition offers her a chance to be recorded on NASA's Golden Record, she recruits a makeshift troop of birdie scouts to try and win.
They can't be birdies. Birdies have a strict quality code.
My booze are quality.
Well, the only number left in the state of Georgia is zero.
So welcome, Troop Zero.
We all got to win one badge each to go to Jamboree.
Buy my cookies so I can be a woman of substance.
Have fun and puke, Miss Rayleigh.
Don't puke before you get the money, boo.
Y'all suck at being girls.
We ain't got nobody to show us how to be better.
Be that one for us.
Like Jesus.
Viola Davis, Allison Janney are also stars of Troop Zero. The film is directed by Bert and Birdie. That's the name that's used by Amber Findlayson and Katie Elwood, who collaborated on it. And Lucy Alabar is the screenwriter. Amy, what'd you think of Troop Zero?
Yeah, I caught Troop Zero at Sundance last year, and that is where this movie belongs. You know, this is the type of just celebration of the oddballs, overly cute and quirky movie that was made to exist at Sundance 10 years ago, get purchased by Fox Searchlight, and be sold to everybody as Little Miss Sunshine Goes to Camp. It is cloying and very cutesy and very exhausting. And you have this little kid. I mean, it's the type of movie where the lead girl's name is Christmas Flint. So when the lead character introduces herself to the camera and talks to the camera a lot as Christmas Flint, you kind of know exactly what you're getting in for. I will say that, you know, I enjoyed Allison Janney as the leader of the hostile rivals of the Birdie Scout troop that are trying to prevent these misfit weirdos from going to this jamboree camp. You know, I almost feel like I'm just waving my hands to explain how the plot is, because it is exactly how it is. But Viola Davis is in here as Christmas Flint's single father's law assistant. And she is actually really funny. So if there's one good thing that came out of watching Troop Zero, it's the idea that there could be a Viola Davis comedy world that I would love to see.
Yeah, she's great in everything. Drama, comedy. I don't know if she sings, but what did you think, Lael?
I think Amy liked it better than I did.
Oh, wow, I didn't like it that much at all.
Well, okay, no, actually, I take that back. I agree with you. It was cloying. It was cutesy. I hated it. I did think it was slightly redeemed by Viola Davis and Allison Janney, but I thought this is basically a ripoff of Little Miss Sunshine, and I don't even think it would have gotten into Sundance 10 years ago. I think, I think there's a few good ideas here, but a few good ideas does not a good movie make.
We're talking about Troop Zero, the comedy from directors Bert and Bertie. It's streaming on Amazon, rated PG. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics think about the sci-fi movie The Wave, Disturbing the Peace, an action film starring Guy Pearce and Devon Sawa, and much more. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you'll come out and join all of us, all the critics and me on stage, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's our 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. We sold out the Ace last year. We want to make sure you get your tickets now. KPCC.org/in-person. Our event earlier this year because the Oscars are considerably earlier this year. The Oscars trying to cut down on that amount of time between when the award season starts and they were finally giving out their honors. So please join us. It's on Sunday morning, February 2nd, 11 in the morning, so you can still watch the Super Bowl that afternoon, 11 a.m., Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, kpcc.org/in-person. The sci-fi film The Wave stars Justin Long. Gil Klaiben is the director, and Carl W. Lucas wrote the screenplay. Amy?
Yeah, this is one of those chaotic movies where you have an uptight person who makes one bad decision, their world is totally rocked and goes completely insane. And the uptight person here is Justin Long, playing this corporate lawyer who specializes in finding loopholes in insurance payouts to make sure dead people's children and widow don't get the money they're deserved. And he's, of course, incredibly bored with his life. And on the night before his big, big, big announcement that he has saved the company $4 million, he goes out with his coworker, Donald Faison. They meet a girl who's played by a really nice face I was happy to see again, Sheila Vance, who was in, she was the star in A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, that Iranian skateboarding movie, if people remember that from a few years ago. And then all chaos absolutely breaks loose. I will say, I found myself really impressed by this movie. You know, it's a first feature, and it has a lot of ambition to it. The way the camera moves, the way that the script is incredibly sharp and very, very funny, very, very cutting. I feel like this is a film where you come out of it saying, that movie was good, but that director is going to be great. And so I'm really happy that I did see this. There's stuff I'd change. There's a nagging wife. Every time you have one of those nagging wives, you're like, all right, here we go. But I feel like this is a team that came together to make a very low-budget movie with a lot of imagination and a lot of style.
The Wave. Yeah. What did you think, Lael?
It doesn't look like a low-budget movie at all. It feels like a fairly accomplished film. It certainly doesn't look like or feel like a first film. Justin Long is perfect for this part. He's got that sort of everyman quality, getting swept up into events beyond his control. He recalls some of the great, you know, 90s and 80s films, whatever, Into the Night, Something Wild. And it's got this great sense of energy that moves forward, this a kind of propulsive feeling to it. And I totally agree with you about the nagging wife. She's the one thing I would have eliminated. But this movie from start to finish kept me engaged, which is, saying something. It doesn't happen that often. So it was quite good. I recommend it.
The Wave, again, directed by Gil Klaiben, feature directing debut for him. The film starring Justin Long, it's rated R. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood and at the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. The Wave, rated R. Disturbing the Peace, an action film starring Guy Pearce and Devon Sawa. The film's directed by York Alec Shackleton, Chuck Hustmeyer, the screenwriter. Lael?
So this is pretty much just a modern Western. It features Guy Pearce as a former Texas Ranger who's got a past, who accidentally killed his partner when his partner was being held hostage, and he's got this baggage that he can never quite get over. So he's laid down his gun and he's become, you know, a man of the law, but he doesn't carry a gun anymore. So then these bad guys come to town, and he's got to have one last duel, kind of a Will Caine High Noon sort of situation, if you will.
And they're bikers, right?
Yeah, they're bikers. So it's a, you know, modern Western, that they're bikers with really big semi-automatic weapons. Guy Pearce is terrific. He can hold any movie. He needs better parts. And it's nice to see him the protagonist in a film. There were problems, I thought, with both the script, the cutting, and some of the script supervising as well, because there were certain inconsistencies that sort of took me out of the movie. Like, you would look, there would be a shot from one angle and then a shot from another, and they didn't match up.
So continuity as well. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely with continuity. But it was, you know, it kept me mostly engaged. It could have been a lot worse. Guy Pearce is always fun to watch.
Disturbing the Peace, Amy.
I think without Guy Pearce, it would have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to have a drinking game this weekend, watch this movie and take a shot every time a bad guy holds a gun to somebody's head and a good guy goes, oh no, do I shoot or not? I mean, that setup happens over and over and over again. This is not a movie where you want to be a hostage. This is also one of those movies where every single girl in the movie has the nighttime soap opera giant blonde hair and midriff shirts. And
I thought they looked kind of like women wrestlers, actually, WWF. A couple of them were, actually.
Incredibly ripped. Mm-hmm. So you get to have like the babelicious blonde on blonde fight that's going to happen here.
Yeah.
I mean, this
You roll your eyes, but for some listeners.
I know. Some people are waiting for that.
Some people, if you have been waiting for a movie where there are very thinly developed blonde delicious babe characters who fight each other and say, like, I'm going to help you save the town, this is your movie. You know, I feel like the director here wants to try to make sort of an elevated genre picture. You know, there's not a lot of dialogue toward the end. He really strips it down to where you're just hearing violins and horses and guns and motorcycles. But I just felt like there was wasted potential in this film. I mean, the idea that Guy Pearce is this marshal who doesn't want to hold a gun, it almost sets up this idea that this could be like a MacGyver or maybe even a MacGruber type of film. But of course, take a bet if you think he's going to pick up a gun. And he's going to shoot it a lot.
Disturbing the Peace, the film, rated R. Guy Pearce, Devon Sawa stars. York Alec Shackleton, the director. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood. The drama Jezebel stars Tiffany Tennille, playing a 19-year-old young woman named Tiffany, who begins to do sex work. She works as a cam girl to help support herself financially. The film is directed and written by Numa Perrier. Amy?
I wish I liked this film more than I do. It's one of those very small, low-budget, miserablest indies that puts its spotlight on a sordid corner of the world and tries to make the audience feel incredibly, incredibly bad. And the story that you have here is that Tiffany lives in a budget suite hotel room with her older sister, who's a phone sex operator. There's kids everywhere. There's her sister's quasi-boyfriend, maybe sort of person, hanging out, her older brother, and she's getting yelled at a lot for not contributing, so her older sister gets her a job as a cam girl. And the movie does not really have much of a sense of who its main characters are. You know, she walks into the cam girl office and she's like, I've never done anything like this. I'm so nervous. I'm so shy. I'm a quiet, quiet, shy person. And within 30 seconds, she's having the time of her life as a cam girl and is so naive, yet she has a crush on a dude who's like sending her messages through the machine. And it all just felt like a bunch of nightmare fuel in search of trying to find any kind of a coherent story. You know, it's shot in just a very naturalistic, raw way. It felt like a lot of the dialogue was added in post-production. Like, people just seemed to be vaguely lip-syncing their lines that weren't really connecting. And so, you know, I want to hope that this film is the start of a director's better career, but this is not a great, great introduction.
Numa Perrier, making her feature directing debut, also wrote the screenplay, also acts in the film Jezebel. It's unrated, and it's streaming on Netflix. The drama in Intrigo, Death of an Author, stars Ben Kingsley and Benno Fuhrmann, Daniel Alfredson, the director and co-screenwriter. Lael?
This is a movie that wants to be a film noir but doesn't really respect the conventions of that genre in order to make it a decent one. So Benno Fuhrmann plays a translator who takes a boat to the island where he finds the man whose work he's translating and decides he wants to tell him the story of his life. So it's got a story within a story, and within that there's another story, which is already too much complication. You can imagine there are people die in mysterious ways. People may even come back to life, some of them. And Benno Fuhrmann, who is the protagonist, who's telling the story of his own life, is looking for guidance from Ben Kingsley. There's very little simpatico between the two men, mostly Kingsley standing around saying, well, if only you weren't such a hack, you could have told a decent story. There's also a sort of a big reveal at the end, but it feels like you've waited too long to get there, and I could sort of see something coming for a while. I also thought there were some continuity issues in this film because Fuhrmann pronounces the name of his own wife differently in different parts of the movie, so I thought that's a problem.
We change and evolve.
I know, right? Exactly. It's not as good a film as it should have been, given the characters involved and given the potential of it.
Intrigo, Death of an Author is rated R. It's at Lemley's Glendale Theater. VHS, a film shot entirely on the VHS and Beta format, follows a 12-year-old kid as he accidentally records home videos and late-night TV shows over his parents' wedding tape. The film's directed by Jack Henry Robbins, who co-wrote the screenplay. Amy?
Yeah, your plot setup is as much plot setup as I think this really needs. VHS All right. exists perfectly in a time where California has legal weed. This is a movie that is just a stream of consciousness, experimental, robot chicken style collage of just interesting things, kooky setups, surreal, weird, awkward phrasing. What you have happening here is just, after that basic setup of the kid taping over his parents' wedding, you really just plunge into about an hour of infomercials, softcore porn videos about Swedish immigrant mechanic space aliens, crime shows, painting lessons, musical performances, commercials, news broadcasts. I mean, this is everything cluttered into one thing, and then it spits back out at the end and becomes a found footage movie once more. The director here is Jack Henry Robbins. He's the son of Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins,
both of whom are in the film,
make cameos, as well as a lot of people from his father's acting troupe,
the actors getting out here. Yeah.
You know, so you have a lot of really interesting, fun people in here. I love seeing Thomas Lennon pop up, for example.
Yeah, he's the best part of the movie, I thought. His little infomercial about, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I won't give too much away.
Lael, what'd you think?
I thought it was weird, and it had moments of profundity. Actually, like it sort of presages global warming when there's a movie within this movie called Hot Winter, which is sort of talking about current trends. But it's I've got a bit too much of everything to be much of anything.
All right, the film VHS is at the Alamo Drafthouse, downtown L.A., and the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. The 1952 Fellini film White Chic is getting a theatrical release. It's the centennial of the birth of Alberto Sordi, who stars in the Fellini film. Amy, for those who haven't seen the comedy, I haven't seen White Chic. What's its claim to fame?
Oh, well, its claim to fame is it is the very first proper feature directed only by Federico Fellini. He'd made a co-production right before this, but this was the first thing that was entirely his. And it's also possibly his sweetest, mildest, lightest and most charming screwball comedy. You know, the setup here is that there's a newlywed girl. She's 20 years old, and she's a huge fangirl for fumetti, which were these comic books done with actual photographs. So you'd flip through and you'd see a photograph of a man who was the white sheik running through and saving the girl who's like the Greek beauty that he's in love with. And so this girl on her honeymoon goes to Rome, and while her husband, who's an uptight, nerdy, menschy guy, falls asleep, she slips out and goes to the set to try to meet the white sheik. And from there, her day, you know, spins into being taken to set, spins into this encounter with the White Sheik himself, who is, he saunters in and he is just a creep, you know? And meanwhile, the husband is trying to explain to his very uptight family where his bride is, trying to cover up for her because they're supposed to go meet the Pope. And I think one of the things that people who love Fellini's work will be happy to see in here if they haven't seen it before is that you have his wife, Giulietta Masina. She comes in as Cabiria and introduces that character 5 years before he'd give Cabiria her own film.
Knights of Cabiria.
She walks in. She convinces a drunk man to blow fireballs at the screen. I mean, it's all very charming and very light.
White Sheik, Federico Fellini's comedy, is at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. and Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena. It's unrated. Also, Saturday night, the 1925 silent classic from Charlie Chaplin, The Gold Rush, have a 35mm screening at the Hollywood Legion Theater at Post 43. Amy, a classic film. This will be with live piano accompaniment.
It will, and by coincidence, I just interviewed the accompanist for my podcast, Unspooled. We did an episode on The Gold Rush that just came out this week, all very coincidental. It's lovely to get to see this movie big. The Gold Rush was Chaplin's massive blockbuster from 1925, where he used a lot of special effects. He had miniatures made that had himself dangling off a cliff on holding onto a house that was about to plunge into the darkness. And what's happening here is this is his story about the Gold Rush exploration, which, you know, was living history at the time. People like Grauman, who hosted the premiere at the Egyptian Theater, had been a gold miner himself. If you want to see Chaplin do the dance of the bread rolls, this is your place. And Clifford Tallick is making his own score to go along with it.
It's the Gold Rush Hollywood Legion Theater at Post 43. We actually have a link to the tickets for the Saturday night screening at the Film Week page, kpcc.org. There's even a discount code for the nonprofit screening. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by our critics Amy Nicholson and Leah Lowenstein. And not just Leah and Amy, but all of our other critics will be on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, exactly 1 week before the Oscars are given out in Hollywood. We'll have all of our critics talking about the major categories of the Oscars. We'll watch clips of the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures, and we invite you to join us. It's on Sunday morning, February 2nd, at 11 o'clock in the morning, earlier start time because it's Super Bowl Sunday, as well as Film Week Sunday. You can get your tickets, kpecc.org/in-person. I hope to see you there. And just a quick programming reminder that Tuesday, the U.S. Senate impeachment trial of President Trump gets underway. Air Talk will be on an hour earlier than usual. We'll come on after Morning Edition from 9 until 10 o'clock, lead into NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump right here on 89.3 KPECC. Well, you've probably heard about the concerns over the years for actors doing sexually intimate scenes for films or for television. And we've done segments on this program where actors have called in and talked about their discomfort, the things that directors have asked them to do, times when protective material wasn't provided to actors, for example, to allow them to keep some degree of modesty as they filmed scenes. Well, this in the era of Me Too has become an even bigger issue, and there's a growing professional field for what are called intimacy coordinators. And they do a number of different things to try and assure that actors are protected on the set, that they're able to speak up and express concerns about things with which they're not comfortable. But they also serve a creative function, too. Joining us is Alicia Rodas, who's the co-founder and associate director of Intimacy Directors International. It's an organization that trains and certifies intimacy coordinators and directors. Alicia is the intimacy coordinator for HBO Studios. Alicia, it's good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
Before we get to the protective, the safety factors of what you and other coordinators do, let's talk about the creative side of this, because, you know, many of us know there have been films and television shows where sex scenes simply don't look realistic. They're not well choreographed, for lack of a better term. And is that something that you and your colleagues are able to provide a bit of improvement in how those scenes can be choreographed?
That's absolutely correct. By definition, outside of being advocates and being liaison between actors and production, we're also choreographers or movement coaches. So, in general, then I want to be clear about this, we are collaborative in this. I've worked with some directors that are absolutely fabulous with going right in and having that exact specificity on asking what it is they want from the performers. But I've also worked with some directors who are like, listen, I don't have the language for this. What's the language for this? This is what I want to accomplish. And we get the opportunity to really collaborate with everyone there. So that's absolutely part of our skill set, part of what it is we do on set.
HBO has the series The Deuce, set in New York City back in the 70s, 80s, during the period when adult entertainment is highly visible in New York City. You have some examples of some of the ways that maybe you worked with cast members and episode directors on that series.
Absolutely. So I was on for season 2 and season 3 of The Deuce. Was an absolutely fabulous show and experience that I got to have out there. So what we would do in general was first talk to the directors and the producers about what it is that they wanted to accomplish from those scenes, really understand what their wish list was on everything. And then after we had our talk and got onto at least what it is that they were going for in the scene, I went and spoke one-on-one to the performers. Now, before that, usually the director would have a conversation with the performers as well, so they could have the chance to really specify what their vision is and what they're looking for, and also even the reasons why, even if it is just, we want it to be really sexy and tantalizing here, that's okay as long as we're all on the same page here. So the actors and the directors would talk, and then I would talk to the actors and talk, make sure we're all on the same page with what the story is, and then we specify what exactly it would be that we should have to make sure that they are safe, but also a little bit of comfort goes a long way in these scenes as well.
I'd love to hear from Film Week listeners who are actors. If you're listening to our live show Friday in the 11 o'clock hour, and you've worked with an intimacy coordinator in anything that you've shot for video, for feature films, for episodic television, we're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. You can also share your experiences on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. It's also a chance for you to talk about difficult circumstances in which you found yourself where you feel an intimacy coordinator or director would have been helpful. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Alicia, obviously with HBO productions, those are big budget productions, major feature films. A lot of the things that are produced are low budget. And do you have a sense whether intimacy directors and coordinators have crossed over into those low budgets, or did they not have the money to hire people like yourself?
I mean, to be honest, I started doing this on independent films and small, even student films back in New York when I started doing this years ago. And, what's great about this field really growing is that the people who are first starting out can go and work for smaller independent films that are low budget, ultra low budget sort of work to also get their feet wet and sort of understand how it is that we work on set. So, I absolutely do believe that this is something that is, and what I have seen is it going out to these smaller independent films and shows as well. But I think that just like anything else, now that this is becoming a common practice, if you're going to do a show or a film where you have a huge amount of intimacy, you might want to make sure you budget for someone who is an expert who is able to come in and assist you with that. It's the same thing on if you were going to do a major car chase. Either you find a different way to tell that story or you make sure you have the budget for those experts in there.
I don't know if it was a concern of directors that somehow having an intimacy coordinator involved would lower the heat of these scenes, that somehow they would be less sexy by having someone like yourself involved in them. Has that ever been expressed to you, and is that a legitimate concern?
I have had that expressed to me by a few different people, by directors, by actors as well. And, you know, what we usually find is that because we have these safeties in place, because we have talked about what exactly we're doing, or at least we know what we're not doing, actors then feel safer and more comfortable to really do their best work. So a scene that might have a lot of apprehension in it and might have a lot of discomfort and anxiety, because we know what's going on and the actors know what's going to be happening, they're able to even rev it up and have it maybe an even sexier scene than what it might have been without this extra assistant.
And is part of that because people are clearer about what the boundaries are, so it's then easier to go up to those boundaries if it's called for, because you know what's too far?
Precisely. One of the intimacy coordinators with us, Claire Warden, says this thing about, you know, if I'm doing parkour and I'm running and jumping and grabbing onto a bar, if I know where that bar is, I can jump full force and nail it. But if I don't know where it is, then maybe I'm not going to be able to find it, and maybe I'm going to fall. And maybe that fear of falling is going to mess with my performance.
We're talking with Alicia Rodas, co-founder, associate director of Intimacy Directors International. The organization trains and certifies intimacy coordinators and directors. She's also the intimacy coordinator for HBO Studios. They work on productions that have sex scenes or intimate physical scenes to help the actors, the whole creative team, create a better and safer experience. Again, if you're a performer or a director who's worked with an intimacy coordinator, I'd like to hear from you at 866-893-KPCC. That is if you're listening Friday live in the 11 o'clock hour. You're listening to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Alicia Rodas is with us, co-founder, associate director of Intimacy Directors International. We're finding out what professionals like her do. Patrick Cady writes on our Film Week page, "I'm a big fan of the intimacy coordinator. I asked for one on my first day of prep while directing CBS All Access's new show Interrogation. It was a fantastic experience. She was a huge help for both me and the cast. Just like a stunt coordinator, I want the set to be a safe place, and this helps make that happen." That's Patrick Cady writing on our Film Week page. Jake in Santa Monica, I understand you've also worked with an intimacy coordinator. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, Larry, we did have one on the set, and I think it made all the difference in the world. You know, she was just there making sure that everybody was comfortable and made sure that the set was cleared with the director. We just took it step by step, and it just made everybody feel more relaxed and at ease.
Jake, can you share with us what the production was you were working on?
So it was a feature production. It was called Spellbound, and we did it right before the holidays, so still waiting for it to be finished up. But we had a pretty intense sex scene. There was a call girl, high-end call girl, and I was one of her clients, and that was the scene that we shot inside of a hotel room.
Okay. Jake, I appreciate it, and good to hear that it was helpful in that production. John in Culver City wants to ask you, Alicia, has there been any consulting that you or others have done for those that are doing sexually explicit films, the adult film or video industry? Have any of your members worked on those productions, Alicia?
You know, it's a great question, not to my knowledge, although I have spoken to a few different companies that have reached out to me from adult films. That is not my specialty. Mine is simulated sex.
Yeah.
So that has not been what I've been doing. And obviously for any of our union members, we can't do any actual sexual acts on set. So as of right now, no, but I know that this is something that could absolutely be useful to also the adult film industry as well. And I know Jessica Steinrock, one of our intimacy coordinators, has been working with Playboy here and there on some of their productions. for some of their photography.
Amy Nicholson, you've recently written about intimacy coordinators.
I did, yeah. I wrote a piece for Variety 2 months ago that was about how in the Me Too era we're figuring out new ways of shooting really difficult intimate scenes so that people have a better experience than, say, someone like, you know, Kim Basinger infamously did when she shot 9.5 weeks. And the one of the people that I found really interesting to talk to was Laureen Scafaria, the director of Hustlers, because on that film, which, you know, is set in a strip club, there's a lot of physical contact, touching, groping, dancing, and performance. She hired a woman named Jacqueline Francis, who was their comfort consultant, as they called it there. And Jacqueline had experience working in, you know, the dancing industry and was able to come in and really put everybody at ease. She said that when they had the giant pans of the nightclub where women are on top of men and everybody's gyrating, that there was another person there who was Jacqueline kind of threading through the room, making sure everybody knew the rules, making sure everybody felt comfortable. And absolutely, as what Alicia said, you know, almost allowing the production to have more freedom because everybody felt like they were on the same page. And what really struck me when I talked to Lorena about it is she said, now that she knows what intimacy counselors can help do, she feels more free as a writer and a director to write more explicit scenes because she knows there's a way to do them safely and that it can actually, as Alicia was saying, maybe lead to even more expression.
One of the things I recall from just this number of years ago when we talked with particularly actresses doing sexually charged scenes, Alicia, was that often there were certain sorts of protections that were offered, even, you know, physical barriers, you know, types of clothing or things that would protect intimate body parts, and that those wouldn't be provided. And it put actors in very bad positions when filming is ready to start and the things that had been promised to them weren't there. Are all of these sorts of things, you know, contractually spelled out, very clear, and are actors able to have backup now if a production doesn't provide things that have been promised?
You know, in general, sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. You know, they're according to our SAG-AFTRA guidelines, we have nudity riders or simulated sex riders or waivers that performers need to have if they're going to be performing nudity and or simulated sex. But, you know, with no one really on top of that explicit department and, you know, at least from what I have seen, the work that we've been doing as intimacy coordinators has been getting a lot more into the nitty gritty than may have happened in the past just because people didn't have the language for that. The great thing about having an intimacy coordinator is that you have someone who is absolutely checking and not leaving it to the wardrobe department, costumes or makeup, having to ask these really uncomfortable questions to actors the day that they're filming. They have someone who's already set out and communicated with wardrobe, costumes and props and makeup exactly what the actors are comfortable with and what's going to work for them. And, you know, the big thing, we've had modesty gear forever. We've had robes for fabulous people on sets that have been helping out with this. But having an sort of an overseer, a true coordinator to all of that, we find is wildly helpful because people talk about modesty gear, but there's modesty and then there's, you know, clothing for modesty and there's clothing for barriers, which really separates that whole idea of, you know, something between genitals, something that makes, that keeps us from asking our actors to do sex work. And there's nothing wrong with sex work in certain circumstances, but that's not what these actors are there to do. They're there to perform a simulated scene.
Ken tweets at Air Talk, I had to do a sex scene in college. I was terrible. Do intimacy coordinators ever do consultation with actors outside of the shoot to help them perform better in these kinds of scenes? Alicia?
Absolutely. In fact, our company IDI, and we're actually launching a new company, Intimacy Directors and Coordinators, called IDC. We do consultations with actors. We do classes and stuff for performers and workshops for performers so that they can also better explore what their boundaries are and know what their boundaries are going in, but also how to really work consensually and know how to speak up for yourself, but also different ways on how to perform scenes like this. You know, I personally work with Columbia University, with Juilliard, with NYU, with a few other groups in New York and also wherever they really take me, doing different workshops and work with performers. And a lot of our intimacy coordinators and intimacy directors for theater do that as well.
Alicia, just real quickly, we're almost out of time, but how do people get into this business? Do they need some sort of a relevant background? Is there a relevant background to get trained to do this?
You know, people have come from different places, but I will say if we're looking to intimacy coordination for film and TV, we ask that people come in with at least 5 to 10 years of film and TV experience, because this is such a new role on set that, you know, we need people within the industry to be helping out with this. But there's plenty of training in mental health first aid, plenty of training in trauma, and just communications in general, and knowing how it is that we can fit.
Yeah. Alicia, we're losing you on the phone, but thank you so much. Alicia Rodas, who is co-founder, associate director of Intimacy Directors International. It trains, certifies intimacy coordinators and directors, and she's HBO Studios' intimacy coordinator. Thank you so much for joining us. And as always, we thank our terrific critics, Leah Lowenstein and Amy Nicholson, for joining us on this week's edition of Film Week. Back with you every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon here on KPCC.